Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
From Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford, this is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolf, and welcome to the first ever Audacious Live Show and Tell. That's right, on March 13th, about 70 people gathered at Third Place by Half Full Brewery in Stamford, and many of the attendees brought objects that had very interesting stories. We heard from 20 people. Some of them were pre-planned guests, and others just showed up with an object. Now, you won't hear all of the stories in this episode. We only have 49 minutes after all, but trust me, they were all so special. Now, I had no idea what anyone brought, except for the violin you're hearing in the background right now. Elaine Braithwaite brought her electric violin, and she played while folks were mingling. You'll hear from her first, and then from Faisal Saleh of Palestine Museum, U.S. So how did this electric violin get in Elaine's hands in the first place?
I bought this one probably about 7 years ago. I decided to venture into the whole world of electric violins. And this was my second violin, actually. I bought a used violin from Sam Ash just to try it out. I was so nervous. And then I eventually bought this violin.
Now, may I say that when I first laid eyes on that violin, when you came in earlier and you did your sound check and you were setting up, the first thing I thought was, that is sexy.
Oh, thank you. It is.
Was that part of the appeal?
No, not really. I like the body. It's a bridge, the manufacturer's bridge, and I just like the violin and the different other instruments that they have. They have cellos, this is a traditional four string, but you can get five string, you can get six string if you want it to sound like a cello, you know, have a deeper sound. Oh. And there's so much you can do with electric instruments, which is, I think, what attracts me to that, to the potential.
So when you see other electric instruments, or even just other electric violins, do you covet them, or do you think, I got the right one?
No, I love all violins. You know, one of the things about me, like, if you come to my house, you look in my dining room, my living room, anytime I see a painting with a violin in it, it can have grapes, I'm like, I'm buying it. It can be a violin by itself. I just love the violin. I've always loved the violin.
Now, tonight you played a bunch of songs that we recognize, but I imagine there are also a few songs that you save for maybe other kinds of performances. What if you could only play one song on this violin? What would that song be?
If I could only play one song, that's a hard one. It's really hard, but I've been studying Jean-Luc Ponty lately.
I don't know that.
Jean-Luc Ponty, he's a violinist. I'm sure a lot of you are fans of his. And I revisit his music a lot, and I've been kind of trying to learn some of his licks, you know, and what he plays.
So it feels like you know this violin, like you've become friends with this violin. Do you feel like it has a soul?
Yeah, it definitely does. You know, I treat all of my instruments that way, you know, because they're like friends, really. Yeah. They're friends. Mm-hmm.
When you hear a little kid playing a violin with all their might, but it's also a little kid playing their violin, how does that feel for you?
I get excited because I love to teach. I love to share. And I love just that potential. Because I remember when I was a child, and I was in elementary school in New York, and we in the auditorium, we got to pick the instrument we wanted to play. And I knew I wanted to play the violin. And I tried the flute also, but it was like, the violin. But it's just that thing of discovery. So whether it's the violin, music, sports, ballet, anything, I just love the discovery that a child has of discovering something for the first time and realizing, I want to do this for the rest of my life. So when I see a child, that's what I think. And if they want to play, you know, I'm there to help them.
Well, thank you so much. A round of applause, Elaine Braithwaite. Thank you so very much. All right, let's see. Next on our list to be coming up here is Faisal Saleh. Coming up, Faisal. So perhaps when you sit down, you can introduce yourself and tell us what we should know about you.
Okay, my name is Faisal Saleh. I'm a Palestinian. American, of course, been a U.S. citizen for a long time, and I paid more taxes than Donald Trump. of course, that's not saying much, really. Anyway, I'm originally from Palestine. My family lived in a village called Salama, just outside of Jaffa, and in 1948 they were refugees, ended up in the West Bank, where I was born 3 years later. I came to the U.S. to finish the last year of my high school in 1969. Those of you who are old enough, you know what happened that year. It was Woodstock, the landing on the moon, and maybe a Grateful Dead concert at the Yale Ball. Anyway, I went to school here, and I worked in business for 45 years. And after that, I started the Palestine Museum U.S. in Woodbridge, Connecticut. We actually put Woodbridge on the world map, literally, because a couple of days ago, I got a Google notification from some World Atlas organization that says 8 places you don't know about in Connecticut to visit, and Woodbridge was one of them.
Hey, Woodbridge!
But then it said Woodbridge, the home of the Palestine Museum U.S.
That's right.
And we do have people from all around the world want to know where Woodbridge is and what it is. So what I have here is my father's passport from the 1940s. On the back of it, it says passport in Arabic and in Hebrew, and also says government of Palestine. And it has my father's name in the bottom here, handwritten. Now, this is the page where the photo is. And
handsome.
And that's the style from back then. People had mustaches that went like that. But they wore ties and suits. The passport is full of stamps. These are visas and border crossing, and it's all full of those. In 1947 and early 48, my father was involved in a number of missions to go to the Arab countries surrounding Palestine, trying to get help for the Palestinians to defend themselves. But none of those Arab countries really came through, and they let the Palestinians fend for themselves, just like what's going on in Gaza right now. You think things changed. It takes, from 1948 to 2024, not a thing has changed. We got all these rich Arab countries that have a lot of money and a lot of resources, and they're letting the Israeli trucks come all the way from Kuwait to drive through Iraq, through Jordan, and deliver goods to Israel. Meanwhile, the Israelis are destroying Gaza and killing people by the thousands. So what's significant about this was issued by the British government in 1917. The League of Nations gave Britain a mandate to govern Palestine and to prepare it for independence. And in reality, Britain was a colonial power. They just treated it just like any other colony, and they prepared it for dispossession. They did everything they can to make sure the Jewish immigration comes from outside, and built a state within the state. And in 1948, the Palestinians were dispossessed and pushed out of Palestine. 750,000, and 500 villages and towns were destroyed and depopulated. And my family was one of those villages. Anyway, so that's what happened. That's when the Palestinian issue started. It did not start on October 7th. It started in 1948. And now everybody's beginning to gradually understand what happened to the Palestinians and what the story is about. At any rate, thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Faisal. Before I let you go, how does it feel to hold it? What does it mean to you to hold it?
Well, my father held it for many years and travel with it. I mean, it is part of our heritage. And the fact that it says Palestine on it, some of you may not appreciate what that means, but Palestine is a name that's facing erasure by a lot of places. And Israel says there's no such thing as Palestine. Never was a Palestine, and there are no such thing as Palestinians. We're just a bunch of Arabs, you know. So this passport is proof that we exist, and we existed, and we continue to exist. So it's more than just a document. It has a lot of meaning. It shows, like, I belong someplace. I mean, we're all American here, but every one of us came from someplace except for the indigenous people who were here when we all came, and when we kicked them out of their land and killed most of them, and we did to them what Israel is doing to the Palestinians now. So one thing I want to say is that this is a great country. The American people have been very supportive and very helpful. And there's a huge gap between the American people and the government, and particularly the representatives in Congress. There's like 500 people in Congress. Not a single one of them would say a word about all these people that are being killed and slaughtered. What's wrong with these people? What planet are they living on? You should see the demonstrations in Washington and in New York and all that. There's hundreds of thousands of people. These are not Palestinians that are demonstrating. Some are, of course, but these are Americans, true-blooded Americans. They don't like this. What's happening. This country was based on democracy. It was based on justice for all and all this stuff. And now, when you find out what the government is doing with your money and all this stuff, it's scary. You know, like, it's being done in our name. And we don't want people doing that kind of stuff in our name.
Thank you so much. That was Faisal Saleh, founder and executive director of Palestine Museum US in Woodbridge, Connecticut. And you heard from Elaine Braithwaite, Bridgeport's city librarian. Next up, Paul Bluestein of Bridgeport. You've heard his voice on Audacious before. He's the husband of Linda Shannon Bluestein. Linda died earlier this year on January 4th in Vermont, surrounded by her family. She was diagnosed with terminal cancer in 2021, and she wanted the option to die in her own home in Bridgeport. So she advocated hard for medical aid in dying, or MAID, to be passed in Connecticut. Now, it has yet to pass in the state, but she did successfully sue the state of Vermont to drop their residency requirements for MAID. I'm going to let Paul take it from here.
When she learned of her diagnosis, she and I knew that she wasn't going to survive that. And she decided that she wanted to leave a legacy. And one of the projects that she undertook was a wind phone. It's very common, as I'm sure you know, for people to, in their grieving, try and find a place and a way to talk to people that they loved. To sometimes say things that never were said, that apologies were needed for, or just to tell someone how the day had been. The first wind phone ever was created by a Japanese landscape designer named Taru Sasaki, who had a garden in his house that he had tended with his cousin, who died. And he missed his cousin very much. And in order to stay in touch with his cousin, he built an old-fashioned phone booth and put in it a telephone, a rotary dial telephone connected to nothing but the wind, and said that his thoughts would be carried on the wind to his cousin. A year later, an earthquake and tsunami struck Japan, And the town where Taro lived was nearly obliterated. In that tsunami and earthquake, 90,000 people died. And he opened his garden to people in Japan, thinking that a few people might want to speak with their loved ones who they had lost. Thousands came. Linda thought that this would be a way for me to stay in touch with her, that I could talk with her because she was going to be cremated and there wasn't going to be a headstone or a cemetery to go to. So she created this idea and had installed the first wind phone in Fairfield County. There are three in Connecticut right now. Two of them are installations that she arranged. One is at the Westport Library, and one is at the Ridgebury Congregational Meeting House. This one is almost certainly going to go at the Greenfield Hills Congregational Church. It turns out that that people were very interested in this idea and have been calling my son and me, who founded a 501c3 corporation, Linda's Phones, and he's in the process of managing the installation of wind phones throughout the United States. And it's been a tribute to Linda's memory and a way for me to never lose her voice in my ear.
Thank you.
You've used this.
Oh, I go and talk with her, and you know, the funny part is, not surprising, I can hear her answer. I can. And there's something about dialing a rotary phone that's it sounds dumb. It sounds like it would be meaningless, but the experience of it is indescribable. There's something about it that's mystical. It's not the same as just picking up a phone, so that I don't know how to explain it or why that happens to me, but it does.
I can feel her here.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Paul.
You're welcome.
Was Dr. Paul Bluestein of Bridgeport. All right, now I want to tell you what I brought for show and tell. It's a small, beautiful piece of gravel. See, when I was a teenager in the 1990s, I was inspired to learn to play the guitar because of singer-songwriter Ani DeFranco. Her percussive, intense playing always hypnotized me. And her lyrics? She could express in two lines a deeply complex and nuanced idea or feeling that it would take me like two whole albums to say. In fact, I did write two albums, inspired by a few very juicy heartbreaks and her music. So Ani DeFranco is kind of a big deal to me.
A couple of years ago, she was playing at Infinity Hall in Norfolk. And I took a picture of the marquee that said Ani DeFranco, and I posted it on Facebook, and I wrote a caption that said, "On a hot date with Ani DeFranco." So my friend Roxana says, "You were at Ani? You should have told me. She's my cousin. I would have introduced you." And then I lost all feeling in my knees. Everything went black. Flash forward a couple of years later, and I'm telling Roxana, you know, I really want to travel more. I was thinking about going to New Orleans. I'd never been to New Orleans before. She goes, you know, Ani lives in New Orleans. So Roxana says, I'm about to turn 55. And it would be really cool. Maybe we can go down to New Orleans and I can celebrate my 55th birthday with you and Ani. I said, that would be great. Flash forward again. We are getting out of a cab at Ani DeFranco's house. And her driveway is made out of gravel. Now, I have to tell you, there's a song of hers called Gravel, and it goes like this. I heard the sound of your bike as your wheels hit the gravel, and then your engine in the driveway cutting off. And I pushed through the screen door, and I stood out on the porch thinking, fight, fight, fight at all costs. But instead, I let you in, just like I'd always done. I sat you down and offered you a beer. And across the kitchen table, I fired several rounds, but you were still sitting there when the smoke cleared, and you came crawling back to say, you want to make good in the end, but oh-ho, let me count the ways I abhor you, and you were never a good lay, and you were never a good friend, but oh-ho, oh, what can I say? I adore you. And so I picked up a piece of gravel from Ani DeFranco's driveway. You're hearing stories from Audacious Live, Show and Tell, taped just last week at Third Place by Half Full Brewery in Stamford. To see photos from the event, visit ctpublic.org/audacious. When we get back, more showing and telling from the staff members of Connecticut Public. I'm Kyone Wolf. This is Audacious. Stay with me. This is what I like best. You've been juggling two women like a stupid circus clown, telling us both we are the one. And maybe you can keep me from ever being happy, but you're not gonna stop me from having fun. So let's go before I change my mind. I'll leave the luggage, all your lies behind, 'cause I am bigger than everything that came.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Hartford HealthCare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers, so we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford HealthCare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolf, and we are back at Third Place by Half Full Brewery in Stamford, Connecticut. Last week, we had a live event there where people brought objects that meant a lot to them, and they shared their stories. Now, I didn't know what anyone was bringing, including members of Connecticut Public staff. So I started off with the two people Audacious listeners know best, but maybe you've never heard their voices. Producers Khalil Rahman and Jessica Severin DeMartinez.
I brought a doily, a round ornamental placemat, around 9 or 10 inches in diameter. It's very soft, it's made of wool, and colors are mainly blue, green, some red.
So what's the deal?
Well, it's a story. I got it, actually my family got it. We got it from Jose, my husband's grandma. So they live in Argentina. All his family live in Argentina. And one year, we decided to travel there for Christmas. And Jose's grandma was 96 years old at the time. And the family thought it would upset her too much. She would worry. She would be really anxious to know that we're traveling with two very young children. She wouldn't sleep, she wouldn't eat if she knew that we were coming all the way from the U.S. It's a 28-hour trip from door to door because they, of course, live far away from the international airport. So they decided not to tell her that we were coming. And we arrived. It was the night before Christmas. And knocked on her door, and she... That face, I will never forget, that face of excitement, disbelief, shock, surprise, and just, she was thrilled. She hugged us all, but the next thing she said is, I don't have a Christmas gift for you.
Aww.
And it was late at night, and Christmas was the next morning, no shops are open. So what do you do when you're 96 years old and want to show that you love them, you spend the night, stay up, and knit this. So, yeah.
Thank you, Jessica. Next, I would love you to meet Khalil Rahman. Khalil, come on up.
So this is a little booklet of Islamic supplications. I'm Muslim, and I got this little booklet at the funeral of a teacher I had in middle school. At her funeral, they decided to pass these out to all of the students and attendees, and this is kind of one of the only objects I've kept for over 10 years. It has supplications for every kind of mundane situations, which was really meaningful to me, kind of any situation you can think of.
Can you read an example?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So you know, if you're before you eat, after you eat, if you forget to say the one before you eat, there's one if you make that mistake.
You forget.
When you're entering the home, when you're entering the market, if you're trying on new clothes, there before you enter the bathroom and after you leave the bathroom, I think the one after you leave the bathroom, in Arabic, it's ghufranak, which means God forgive me, which, yeah. I think we've all been there. Did we miss anybody out? But yeah, this is an item that's kind of stuck with me for a while. And I think the influence it's had on me has been really profound. I don't really think a lot about the idea of legacy, but I would hope that my life and work has a positive impact on people. And I think this was such a great way that this teacher, Ru'a Taha, who passed away when she was very young, I think she was close to my age, and 27, I think. And I think when you're a kid, you don't realize how young the adults in your life are, but looking at her, you know, and where she was in her life now, I think she was recently engaged, and she passed very suddenly, but you know, seeing how she was able to have such a deep impact with me and everybody else in attendance who got one of these, and I think the idea, you know, whether you're religious or not, the idea of having perspective and gratitude, not just going through the motions of life, and trying to take that perspective in these mundane aspects of life, I think it's been really profound and really helpful to me.
Khalil Rahman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, next up, a familiar voice to Connecticut residents, Lucy Nalpathanchel. She was a reporter at Connecticut Public for a long time and former host of our daily talk show, Where We Live. Now, she's the vice president of community engagement, which means she makes events like this one happen. Thanks, Lucy. Here's where her story begins.
How many of you listened to Weezer growing up? How many of you listen to Weezer now? Go ahead, you can admit it. So this is the album Ratitude, and this was my dog, Sydney. So obviously the question always is, well, how in the world did your dog end up on the cover of Ratitude? So before I had children, Sydney was our first child, and we had gone out, my husband and I, and thinking that our dog missed us, we were gone doing errands, we wanted to reward him, and so we went out and got a pig ear, and my husband was an amateur photographer, and so he took this picture of Sydney jumping for the pig ear. Again, how in the world did this end up on the cover of Ratitude? So because my husband, Jason Neely, is an amateur photographer, he submitted this photo to the Your Shot section of National Geographic. Has anyone seen that, where it's people taking pictures and not professional photographers? And National Geographic chose this picture because it is pretty amazing, or right?
He's just, for those who can't see, this dog is flying through the air in a living room.
And now you know the backstory, because he had a pig ear being dangled in front of him. So the picture was put in National Geographic. We thought, that's so cool, right? So one day, my husband was reading his email before work, and I was getting ready for work. And he's like, Lucy, I just got an email from Interscope Records. And being the cynical journalist, oh, that's a scam. Why would Interscope Records be emailing you? Well, it was the manager of Weezer, and the email went, we were sitting at an airport, and Rivers Cuomo saw the picture of your dog, Sydney, and he thought, ratitude. And you're probably wondering, well, how in the world how are they able to get your contact info? So remember Flickr?
The photo sharing website.
Your photographs on Flickr. So that's where Jason, my husband, put this picture of Sydney, and they were able to look into, well, who took this photograph? It's Jason Neely in National Geographic, and that's how they found his email. And fast forward, we agreed to have our dog Sydney on the cover of Ratitude. So MTV wanted him to come to New York City so that Rivers Cuomo could interview him. And we're like, you know, Sydney's a country dog. I don't think he would like Manhattan. So they came to us. And at the time, we were living in Middletown. And so these two hipsters from Brooklyn show up at our house. And this was before Zoom. This is 2009. And so they recorded Sydney doing dog things, like sitting there, panting, drinking water, barking. And they were able to edit this video. And you can look it up. Rivers Cuomo interviews Sydney from Ratitude. And they were able to edit it where it looks like Rivers Cuomo is interviewing Sydney.
Yo, Sydney, what's up? Good to see you, my man. Let's have a chat. Well, we saw that picture of you jumping through the air, and we were like, whoa, that's exactly how we feel when we're on stage every night. We get midway through the set, we got all this blood flowing. Suddenly, we're able to pull off these amazing stunts, just like you, Sydney.
So, you know, Sydney left us in 2019. He was the best dog. But this is what we remember, is that he was the greatest dog, and he's now on an album cover, considered one of the most famous dog covers.
To Sydney! Lucy, thank you. We're going out with I'm Your Daddy by Weezer. Who's in the music video for this song? It's Sydney, of course. We'll link to it and have photos from the show at ctpublic.org/audacious. After the break. How many whiskers do you think is in there?
I have no idea.
A lot of whiskers.
3 years worth of whiskers.
I'm Kyone Wolf. This is Audacious Live, show and tell at Third Place by Half Full Brewery in Stamford. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Many factors impact a child's achievement. To start, they need the basics like access to healthy food and quality health care. Join me, Lucy Nalpathanchil, as Connecticut Public and the Connecticut Black and Brown Student Union host a one-hour conversation about the importance of safe housing. Wednesday, May 8th at 6:30 p.m. at the Guard Arts Center in New London. Register at ctpublic.org/safehousing.
This is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolf, and welcome back to Audacious Live, Show and Tell. It was recorded just last week in Stamford, and about 70 people showed up. Many of them brought objects they wanted to show and tell us about. We had a vase at check-in where people could drop their names. During the event, I pulled them out at random, and they joined me on stage. Jennifer Riley and her mom, Stephanie Convey, came all the way to Stamford from Wethersfield, Connecticut.
This is bronze. It is a boa constrictor who swallowed an elephant. And if anybody read The Little Prince, they know it comes from The Little Prince, yes. And Jennifer made it for me. She made it in college, bronze. And it's just absolutely delightful, and I've loved it and saved it ever since.
And for those who don't know the story, maybe give us a little context.
So in the story, the young character, the little prince, is interacting with an adult and wants to test and see if he still thinks like a kid or he's stuck in the singular focus of the adult world. And so he had a drawing that, in profile, most adults would say looks like a hat. And then the other character was certain that it was a hat, but the little prince said, no, if you look at it differently, it's a snake that has swallowed an elephant. And so my mother loved this story, and she gave me the book in French when I was little and I couldn't read any of it at all. But I loved the pictures, and so one of my first bronze pieces in college was making the snake that ate the elephant.
Yeah. Stephanie, when you hold this in your hands, what does it feel like?
It's warm. It's quite warm. I just think of Jennifer every time I touch it. Yeah.
What do you love so much about her?
She's very funny. She's got a marvelous sense of humor, and she's good at everything that she does. She's a wonderful teacher and a wonderful mother and husband, wife, and I've got three other children too, so I can't say that she's you can't do that. But she's very close to me, and she always has been.
Yeah. Jennifer, what do you love so much about your mom?
She always sees the elephant.
Round of applause, Jennifer and Stephanie. Thank you so much.
All right, the next wild cards, Chet Raymond from West Haven and Cynthia Bowser from Stamford. I asked Chet, before she tells us about the thing that she brought, what should we know about her?
There's a million things you can know about me, but the cats are the most important thing. Anybody cat people here?
Yes.
Cat moms? Yeah, okay. And I actually was thinking my cats sort of represent my second life post-divorce, post-kids not caring about me anymore. So my cats have become my family, my housemates, my everything. And so I got two girl cats, and then 2 years later, two boy cats. And approximately 3 years ago, I started collecting their whiskers. And
so the whiskers.
I brought the whiskers.
It's a jar of whiskers.
A jar of whiskers. Because there's so many times
Can I touch it?
Yes. There's so many times when, you know, you're just walking around the house and you see a little whisker and it's like, it's a part of them and it's just special.
Yeah, and if you find a whisker of your cat, like to throw it away feels sacrilegious.
Yes. I actually found one this morning. I had already sealed this up, so I didn't put it in. I put it on the white sink thinking it's a black whisker. It's special. I'll see it. I'll get it later. I think my cat Hutch ate it. Because I have a cat that eats things he shouldn't. And
how many whiskers do you think is in there?
I have no idea.
A lot of whiskers.
3 years worth of whiskers. I have four cats, so they lose a whisker every 6 to 8 weeks.
Have you heard about how if you have a cat and you have a bowl, they may get whisker fatigue?
Yes.
Right? Because their whiskers are rubbing against the bowl.
My friend Tim made me some bowls so that they don't get whisker fatigue.
Low bowls.
Low bowls.
Perhaps plates.
Yeah. Stackable plates so they can go in the Tupperware so that they can't, you know, eat the food when they're not supposed to.
So if you were at my house, your own cats are your people. They're your family.
They are.
So if you were at my house, my cat's name is Whiskey. And if you found one of Whiskey's whiskers, would you take it for yourself or would you give it to me?
I actually almost brought that black whisker today, but Hutch ate it. I was going to give it to you.
Oh, for me?
Yeah, I was going to bring it to you.
What would you like me to have done with it?
Start your own collection. I would inspire anybody, start your own collection and be that weird cat lady or cat dad or whatever, and be the one that collects whiskers.
Is there any other part of your cat that you collect?
Okay, so some of my coworkers and I, we felt things out of wool, you know, and I have at times collected a ball of Nevi, and I have thought, oh, I should bring this into work and felt it, but I haven't yet. I always throw that away, but I could easily swipe twice and get a fluff.
My best friend Michelle has a large cat named Norman, and when she gets the fur off of him, she makes him tiny hats of his own fur.
That's adorable.
Consider it.
Okay. Thank you.
Chet, everybody. Thank you so much, Chet. The next wild card is Cynthia. Let's hear it for Cynthia. What did you bring?
I brought my hat. I originally was supposed to bring James Brown, but I was running late and I left him on the counter. James is very important in terms of my development as a young person on the West Side, because he just sang great music and he started off the Black Revolution with "I'm Black and I'm Proud." Mm. And so as I sit here tonight, I'm wearing a hat, which is really my mom's symbol. My mom passed away in 2016 at the age of 96 years old. She was a woman full of grace and pride and delicacy, and everybody wanted to know what happened to me. You see, I plopped down in the chair. I have to curse and say, I'm just like my dad. But he was a great person too, but he didn't have the delicacy of my mom. And my mom really was an exceptional woman, because she really was a symbol of kindness, a symbol of hope, a symbol of tenacity, a symbol of resilience, no matter what you face. And for me today, it kind of keeps me lit. Children on my street, Rose Park, when they were young, they remembered my mom. My mom swept that street from end to end, every morning and every afternoon, to make sure those children would have a clean street to come to, because people had such negative ideas and feelings about people who live on the west side of Stamford. As I sit here tonight, I want to say that we have wonderful people on the west side, that we're a changing community. We are no longer Black, Italian, and Irish. We are now many people from Central and South America, people from Bangladesh, and we have pride, but we also have some income issues. And today, it's very ironic that I sit here, because this was the place I came when Mayor Simmons was elected, when she was celebrated, and today was the day that there was a hearing at the state in regard to issues dealing with zoning. I happened to serve on the Charter Revision Commission, and it was just so astounding to see the lack of citizen participation. I come from a time where the West Side had a lot of citizen participation. Politicians walked the stoop and they talked to people to find out what they wanted. And then they went to do what the people asked them to do. So I sit here with this hat in memory of my mom and of her style. And I sit here to say that we're all resilient and that we're all wonderful people. But we need to make sure that we get mutually beneficial outcomes for everyone. This is a city and a country of immigrants. Let us not forget that. Let us not forget that people came here fleeing harm, seeking better. That it's become more difficult to get here, and the world's becoming a more cruel place to be. It's hard to accept the kinds of death. I can't even look at TV. Thank God for 88.5. They're my 24-hour station, and I thank you for what you do. But I'm here today representing my mom with her hat because I left James at home.
Cynthia, thank you so much.
Say it loud. Say it loud.
That was Cynthia Bowser from Stanford and Chet Raymond from West Haven. Our final wild card is Kristen Cusato from Fairfield. When she joined me on stage, she asked me to put out my hand. When I did, she pantomimed putting something in my palm and closed my fingers around it, but nothing was there.
That's really important.
What did you put in there?
I'll tell you. My mother, every day and every year on my birthday at 2:10 p.m., would call me and say, "Happy birthday! This is the time when I met my best friend." Mom and I were best friends. She was 21, so she had me kind of young, so we grew up together. We weren't like Gilmore Girls, which was she like 15 when she had us, so it wasn't like Gilmore Girls young, but 21 young. She sewed my Halloween costumes, Holly Hobby and Peter Pan. She did my hair for my 8th grade dinner dance. I think it was like a braid right here. She held my hand when I gushed over my crushes that didn't put the note back in my locker, yes or no. Did you like me, yes or no?
Fools.
Thank you. She just was everything to me. She and I were best friends. I supported her through her divorce. She supported me through my divorce. So it was no surprise that when she was diagnosed with dementia at the age of 61, I turned my world upside down and left California and came to back to the East Coast to help care for her. And those of you who've been on this journey, I know there are several actually in the room, it is ugly and it is hard and it is challenging, but it is beautiful and it has lots of beautiful moments and it is happy and sometimes it's even funny and it's inspirational. So Mom was amazing. Mom was a mother of two, and she was a just a strong woman. She was the second female president of her Rotary Club. Woo-hoo. Very exciting. but as you may know with this disease, you mourn the losses of function. So when she couldn't feed herself anymore, you mourn that. When she could no longer walk, you mourn that. When she could no longer talk, you mourn that. And I think the last time that she brushed her hair, she was using a toothbrush because she knew she was doing something in front of a mirror with a brush, didn't know where it went. So the toothbrush and the toothpaste went in the hair. It wasn't very long after that kind of thing where she just was rendered not able to speak. And we were sitting together, and she was sitting in her chair, and she had something. And just to let you know, Lewy body dementia, which was the type of dementia she had, shows some hallucinations early on. So she had some hallucinations. And she took something and she handed it to me. I put my hand out and she put it in there. And there was nothing there. And what I learned was that you need to go into their reality and validate what they have. So I took it and I put it in my pocket and I said, "Thank you, Mom. Thank you very much." Probably about a year later, she passed away at the age of 65. I was with her, we were holding hands. And I realized she gave me so many gifts, but what she gave me at that moment, the woman who no longer had a voice, was the empowerment and me to use my voice to tell her story. I now work for the Alzheimer's Association. And I share people's voices and I help them craft their stories so they can help other caregivers, so they can speak to lawmakers and make change, so they can talk to healthcare workers, so that they understand what it's like to live with this disease, from people who live with it, from caregivers, all the rest. So even though you don't know what I put in there, it's empty. And it was empty when she put it here. It's not. It's everything. It's her essence and her goodness. And I use it every day, and I'm grateful.
Me too. Kristen, thanks. I'll hold on to that.
That was Kristen Cusato. She's the director of communications for the Alzheimer's Association of Connecticut, and she's the host of the podcast Speaking of Alzheimer's. This special episode of Audacious was the result of the loving and meticulous work of Jessica Severin DiMartinez, Khalil Rahman, Meg Fitzgerald, Meg Dalton, and Katie Talarski at Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford. Special thanks to Vice President of Community Engagement, Lucy Nalpathanchel, for being the force behind all of these amazing live events. Let us know where you'd like us to bring Show and Tell next, audacious@ctpublic.org, or you can find me on the socials at Kyone Wolf. So many people help this event run like a well-oiled public radio machine. All parts of our organization contributed, with special thanks to these colleagues who supported us in Stanford with their talent and expertise. Johnny Malloy, Megan Boone, Bradley O'Connor, Jess Ganella, Sabrina Herrera, Janae Spinato, Dave Wurzel, Deirdre Tavara, Corey Boudelier, Zach Champy, Lauren Komrosky, Julianne Veracci, Joe Koss, and Connecticut Public President and CEO Mark Contreras. Special thanks to everybody who came out to Show and Tell with us, and to PJ Kennedy from HeyStanford.com. That's a lifestyle guide for anybody living in or visiting Stanford. You can see photos at ctpublic.org, and you can see the sweetest videos our social media team made by following at ctpublic on Instagram and TikTok. And of course, enormous thanks to the super friendly and helpful staff at Third Place by Half Full Brewery in Stamford. And thanks to you for listening.